It's amazing that the founder of the largest religion in the history of the world, Paul, with Christianity, began his opening diatribe with a rambling introductory sentence that was filled with lies. The continuation of his opening sentence in his first letter, this is now Galatians 1:4, reads as follows, and bear with me, it's long, and this is just another dependent clause in the opening sentence. I mean, the first three verses of Galatians were part of this sentence, and it continues on past this clause. But this is a complex clause all by itself. And before I read it to you, and I've shared it with you once before, one of the things that you learn if you're writing for the purpose of communicating, and, you know, I've written now Prophet of Doom, which was written to communicate the terrorist nature of the Islamic religion using its Quran and Hadith as the sole sources. And then Yada Ya, which communicates the absolute proof that a God whose name is Yahweh created the universe, life within it, and then authored his Torah for the purpose of inviting us to participate in his covenant family. And after that, a book called Questioning Paul, which we're covering now, to prove conclusively that Paul was a false prophet, that he was the plague of death. And lastly, an introduction to God, along with two other books that I wrote previously, In the Company of Good and Evil, and also Tea with Terrorists. That one of the things you learn if you're going to write these kinds of exposés is that sentence length is important. Now, if you go back a while ago, people, I think, were brighter and their sentences were longer, paragraphs were longer. They aren't anymore. Our attention span has shrunk. But if you look at just good communication, you don't use run-on sentences. People lose track of the subject and object and the verbs and who is doing what to whom. It is vastly more effective to communicate in relatively short sentences, in relatively constrained paragraphs, easier for people to understand. But that wasn't the purpose of Paul's letter. It was not to increase understanding. If it was, he would never have begun with this kind of a run-on sentence. It was to position himself as the voice, as the only one allowed to speak on behalf of God. That's why he just laid out and didn't stop a run-on sentence. The one having given, this is Didomai, having produced and allowed himself on account of the sins, the wrongdoing, wanderings away, and errors of us, so that he might possibly gouge or tear out, exario. He might choose to pick, pluck, root, or take out. This was written in the aorist tense that depicts a moment in time. In the middle voice, he, not we, is affected by his actions. And in the subjective mood, which means this is merely a possibility, that he might possibly gouge or tear out us from the past inflexible and unrelenting circumstances of the old system, aeonos, the previous era, the long period of time in history operating as a universal or worldly system, as something that was in existence in the earliest or prior times that continued over a long period of time. It's a compound of ai, which means circumstances which are incessant, unremitting, relentless, invariable, and inflexible, which had been in place, which had occurred in the past, but was influencing the present circumstances in which we are placed, which is disadvantageous and is harmful, poneros, which is wicked and worthless, evil and faulty, immoral and corrupt, annoying and mischievous, laborious and criminal, unprofitable and useless, unserviceable and malicious, malevolent and malignant. Down from and in opposition to the desire and will of the God and the Father of us. Galatians 1:4. What on earth do you think that Paul is talking about here? Well, what he's talking about is that rather than Yahusha having liberated us from our religious and political sin, having de-yeasted us on matzah, removing the fungus of human institutions that corrupt our thinking and our relationship, rather than him making a sacrifice on matzah to perfect us so that we can be adopted into Yahweh's family, Paul is writing that his Iesu, Arisu, Christu, was trying to gouge us out of, to tear us away from, to pick and pluck and take us out of something. It wasn't he was taking us away from our sin. He wasn't tearing us away from our infidelity. No, he has the sacrifice of Yahusha designed to take us away from the past system, from the old system, from what Christians call the Old Testament. That is what Ionis is conveying to us. He's talking about that from his point of view, Yahusha didn't come to fulfill the Torah. He didn't come to explain the Torah. He didn't come to honor the Torah. He didn't come to expose the Torah. He didn't come to observe the Torah. No, he came to obliterate our relationship with the Torah. That's what he means by the old system. That which is inflexible and unrelenting. The previous circumstance. The Old Testament. He's creating his new religion with these words. A religion that is universally opposed to the Old Testament, to the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, to its God, to its covenant, to its invitations to meet seven times a year, to its Sabbath, to its people, to its promised land. It's blatant, folks. It's obvious. It's undeniable. He has his caricature of Iesu Christu, the Christian Jesus Christ, who is really Satan, trying to remove us from the Torah. And he affirms this with the next vowel. That old system which had been in place from the next verb in estimai, which had occurred in the past but was influencing the present circumstances, which had been place depicting where we had come from and now find ourselves presently threatened by a previous edit. Beyond that, most of Galatians will go as far as to say that this Torah system, this old system, this Old Testament was relentless, inflexible, unremitting. He is here, right at the beginning, taking a shot at the Torah. In fact, his comments regarding Yahweh's Torah, prophets, and Psalms, because this is the entire old system, so this would be the entirety of the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, he goes as far as to call it poneros. Now, most of you listening probably are not familiar with Greek, but you probably are familiar with that term. Because poneros became pornography. The English word pornography is based on paneros, that which is disadvantageous and harmful, wicked and worthless, evil and faulty, immoral and corrupt, annoying, mischievous, laborious, criminal, unprofitable, useless, unserviceable, malicious, malevolent, malignant. Paneros. Paul is calling the entirety of Yahweh's testimony, his Torah, prophets, and Psalms, called by Christians the Old Testament, from this old system terminology that Paul is introducing here. He's calling it pornographic. And yet, in the same sentence, he claims that he was inspired by this God. Now, can you imagine the probability of the God who authored the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, who explained his role in creation, introduced himself by name, liberated his people from slavery, introduced his covenant, and facilitated it by himself, fulfilling the first four, Moed Mikre, so that we could engage in a relationship with him, all of which is conveyed in the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, with him inspiring a man to say that his Torah, prophets, and Psalms are pornographic. You'd have to be out of your mind at this point to think Paul was telling the truth. Absolutely irrational. Paul has just proven by this statement that he's not just dishonest, that he is not just being presumptuous and claiming that he speaks for God when in fact he speaks against them. He is doing so in an arena where he, by claiming to speak for God and actually speaking for the adversary, he's doing the single worst, perpetrating the single worst, most deadly crime that any human could possibly engage in. This is why Yahweh, speaking directly of Paul, calling him by name, identifying the time that he would appear, identifying the message he would convey, identifying the audience that he would speak to, identifying circumcision as the issue that he would have, calling him Shaul, his given name, calls this particular man, for this particular reason, the plague of death. Do I have your attention? According to Paul, the Christian Jesus Christ didn't come to fulfill the Torah, didn't come to observe the Torah, didn't come to explain the Torah, didn't come to comment on the Torah, didn't come as the living embodiment of the Torah, didn't come to honor the Torah's promises so that the covenant's benefits could be facilitated. Nope. He came to take us away, to tear us away from the Torah, the prophets, and the Psalms, the old system which had been in place. So why? That Paul could create his new system, his new religion. The faith based on the gospel of grace. That religion is Christianity. It is based, predicated on this opening statement, which is a lie. And yet in every Christian Bible, you will find this text prominently displayed, along with this liar's other letters, with Christians beguiled, unthinking, irrational, ignorant, clinging to the untenable position that this guy was inspired by God. It is senseless. Absolutely senseless. He called the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, the old system, the Old Testament, Yahweh's entire communication to humankind, pornographic. And yet, 3 billion people in the world today, perhaps as many as 10 billion, have been beguiled by this moron to believe this bastard spoke for God. You know, and what's even more amazing, not only is this statement impossible, it's absolutely irrational. It proves emphatically that he was lying, that he is now proposing a religion, in place of the Torah instructions, calling and demeaning the Torah as pornographic. That this fellow admitted the obvious, that he was demon-possessed. Read 2 Corinthians. He admits it. He even admits that he was insane. He admits that he was murderous. But more than this, Yahweh specifically warned us about this man. He told everyone that if you become intoxicated with his circular reasoning, with his deceptions, with his lifeless presumptions, you will not be satisfied. You're going to die. Just as he is Shaul, the plague of death. I am saddened that so many people have been beguiled by something this obviously false. But it is true. That this man pretending to write for God the Father actually was writing for the adversary. Well, it's a small copy edit, modern Greek text. Use hyper between giving himself and us missing the mark, but on Papyrus 46, which is what we're using to reveal this text and testimony, we find peri instead. While those words convey similar thoughts, hyper, meaning for the sake of and in place of, makes a stronger case, which is why the scribes may have replaced it with peri, knowing that Paul just called the Old Testament. First, he designated it as the Old Testament. Yahweh would never, and Yosha never referred to it as an Old Testament, ever. I mean, the Christian terms Bible, New Testament, Old Testament were never uttered by God. And in fact, God would be universally opposed to all four of the Christian distinctions. Bible is the name of a pagan sun goddess. God would never refer to his testimony as Bible. Ever. In fact, someone doing so, he is going to say, you're an abomination. Number two, God never referred to his Torah, prophets, and Psalms as an Old Testament. They are his testimony, period. That's the beauty of Hebrew. There is no past tense in Hebrew. There's no such thing as this transition between that which was and that which will be. Everything he said would endure forever. Number three, there's no such thing as a New Testament. There will be a renewed covenant, but it has not been renewed yet, which means there is no basis whatsoever, according to God, for a New Testament. And number four, of course, that New Testament is always referred to as Gospels. There are no Gospels. That's a pagan term. Even this notion that personal letters should be considered as divinely inspired is absolutely nonsense. When God inspires, it's not letters. We'll be back. There are some insights that can be gleaned from this dependent clause, all of which are religiously horrendous. First, once we come to understand that that Yahusha, meaning Yahweh saves, and that is his name, we know that Yahweh is the one who personally gave himself for us. It's not some third person or second person of a trinity. Yahusha means Yahweh saves. Yahweh is the Savior. He is the one who saved us. All Yahusha is a diminished manifestation of Yahweh set apart from him. It's part of God set apart from him. Transformed from that portion from energy to matter, and therefore gargantuanly diminished. However, when these clauses are joined, we find Paul claiming that his Lord, Jesu Christu, was the one giving himself. But that's not true. It's not Jesu Christu. It's Yahweh. And this is not a small distinction. It defines the very purpose and nature of God and the basis of the Christian religion. That's huge. The problem of Christianity is twofold. Well, threefold. Well, it's probably a thousandfold, but let me just give you these three. The first is that at a place named after the Greek god of victory, the Council of Nicaea, the Christian religion came to be based upon a man, a caricature of an individual that was modeled after Dionysus, and that became the focus of the religion. It wasn't named after Yahweh. It wasn't named after Yisrael. It wasn't named after Yahuda. It wasn't named after anything that Yahweh would hold dear, like his Torah. It was named after an individual. And in fact, what became the individual's last name, even though there's no basis for that. And it was based upon an individual. But the moment you focus on, you begin to base your religion, your relationship on this individual, you miss the entirety of the message, which is this individual is not a unique individual. He is not distinct in any way from Yahweh. He's just a diminished manifestation of Yahweh set apart from him. And so to focus on the diminished manifestation as opposed to Yahweh, to quote the host of this program, stupid. The second thing, of course, is that the Jesus Christ that Christians fabricated at the Council of Nicaea was based entirely on Dionysus, having nothing to do with the actual individual, his actual name, his actual title, his actual purpose, his genuine origin, or the fact that he was Torah observant. These are the kinds of things that just destroy the credibility of Christianity. And when you come to realize that it isn't Yahusha, that it's Yahweh, and that if you don't know Yahweh, then you can't engage in a relationship with him. If you don't know that Yahweh is your Savior, then you aren't saved. Jesus Christ isn't the Savior. And that's the key element of this. Going on, you recognize that Paul expressly denounces this connection with hopos, which is a marker of an indefinite means. By including it in this introductory statement, he infers that the methods deployed by God to save us were not planned. They did not unfold on a fixed or appointed schedule, and that the means were unclear, vague, and imprecise. Of course, that's wholly untrue. It happened in year 4000 Yah, just as it was predicted in the fourth day of creation. On God's schedule, 6 plus 1 equals 7. And the schedule was to arrive in Jerusalem 4 days before Passover to fulfill Passover, Matzah, Bukurim, and Shavuot, which is exactly what he did according to his plan. And yet, by using hopos, Paul is saying, no, just spontaneous event, wasn't planned. Because if it's planned, then you have to go look at the plan. If it's planned, you have to look at the planner. And Paul described the plan, and the planner is pornographic. So it's instructive for you to know that Yahweh set apart from himself a diminished corporeal manifestation to cure us from our sins. In this way, Yahusha's body served as the Passover lamb, and his soul, once associated with our mistakes, was placed in Sheol on the Shabbat to honor the promise to perfect us on unyeasted bread. But none of this occurred according to Paul. No, none of it. He didn't mention any of that. No, he had his Lord, which is Satan's name and title, sleep through it all. Remember? And he must have awakened in a horrible mood, at least based upon this angry and violent verb his apostle has now ascribed to him, which means he might gouge out, tear, and pluck us away from. Reminds me of Paul's term for the rapture, harpazo, which is to viciously pluck away. Perhaps the transformation from Shaul, the murderous rabbi, to Paulos, the Lord's apostle, was a bit overstated. By any standard, the most, at least it's especially, and most especially in this context, the exerio was a poor choice of words. It literally speaks of gouging and tearing out, in addition to plucking and rooting out. Yes, exerio can also convey to rescue, to remove, and to take out, but when these softer approaches are connected with what the Lord Jesu Christu is allegedly delivering us from, it only gets worse. In the Complete Word Study Dictionary, the primary definition of exerio is to take or to pluck out an eye. So you can't observe. So you can't see. They provided this example because both times Yosha is translated using the verb, because he spoke in Hebrew. It is to depict the plucking out of an eye. The only other time exerio is used by other than Paul, Stephen is translated in Acts, because he also spoke Hebrew, telling the high priest that Yosef was exerio, delivered from all of his afflictions. Reflecting this usage, the secondary definition in the Complete Word Study Dictionary is to take out of affliction. So in a moment, we'll consider the source of that affliction, according to Paul, which this Lord is supposedly rescuing us from, gouging us away from, plucking us away from. The Dictionary of Biblical Languages concurs with its peers, reporting that exerio principally means to take out, to gouge out, and to tear out. Secondarily, they attest that it can convey to rescue and set free. Then they point us to its root, which is heromai, which means to choose. Now, that's really interesting. But this, too, is a problem. While Yahweh has every right to choose whomever he wants, for the most part, the option is ours. We're given free will so that we can choose to engage in the relationship with Yahweh or not, or choose a religious alternative like the one being presented here in Galatians. Moving on, the exegetical dictionary lists pluck it out as its favored definition. This is supported by Strong's lexicon, which presents to pluck out as the most accurate depiction of this verb. It is hardly a loving embrace. Nonetheless, Paulos was a violent man, and so he loved violent terms. He uses them throughout his testimony. And he deployed exerio in the aorist tense, which depicts an isolated moment in time without any respect to any process or plan. As such, the sacrifices made by Paul's Lord were random events rather than promised or part of a plan. They didn't occur on a prescribed schedule, all of which is untrue, inconsistent with Yahweh's testimony, inconsistent with Yahusha's testimony. In the middle voice, Paulos' Lord is being affected by his own actions, which could only be valid if the Lord is Satan, not Yahusha. With regard to Yahusha's sacrifices, it is Yahweh's covenant children who benefit from them. But if Paul's Lord is Satan, then it's the adversary who is the most favorably affected by this Pauline inversion of the truth. And last but not least, by using the subjunctive mood, faith becomes operative, because it presents a mere possibility that what Paul is saying is true. This has been a horrendous beginning. with the rejection of the of his own Hebrew name, Shaul, with the selection of a Roman moniker, Paulos, the unfounded boast of being named an apostle, denying his rabbinical training and its influence, inverting the order of Yahusha's title and name not once but twice, inferring that God slept through the most important aspect of his mission, that of matzah, and that his corpse was reanimated, suggesting that he had followers, specifically noting that the pagan graces were now operative in his new religion, revealing that his God was the Lord, which is Satan's title and name, inferring that there had been no plan, that God's schedule and timing were irrelevant, only to write that his Lord was now plucking us away from something. But from what, do you suppose, was Paulos' Lord tearing us away from? Well, to answer that question, we have to isolate the specific einomos, prolonged circumstance, old or new system, or era, past, present, or future, that Paul is labeling corrupt and worthless with the adjective poneros. Back in a moment. So the system, the old system that Paul is causing poneros, pornographic, corrupt, worthless, which we have been plucked away from by his Lord, is the system in which we have been placed. With the verb scribed in the completed variation of the past tense, where there is a lingering effect, we can be fairly sure that the subject this verb and adjective are addressing with anaios is a previous or old system, because it's written in the past tense, completed past tense. So it has to be a previous or old system to which we've been placed, under which, at least according to Paul, people are still being adversely influenced. So while the identity of this entity should be obvious, since knowing for certain is vital to our understanding of Shaul's intent, please bear with me for a while longer as we uncover something which is quite disturbing. In a general sense, anoios can be used to address any era or age, past, present, or future. But the present or future is discounted when it's conjugated in the past tense. It speaks of prolonged periods of time, even of so many lifetimes that these periods might now seem as forever. It reflects eons and ages, which is why it is always or often translated forever or into perpetuity. Aionos is used to describe worldly systems and universal circumstances. But not every condition can be conveyed using aionos, based upon the fact that AEI, which is the base of the word, describes circumstances which are incessant, unremitting, relentless, invariable, and inflexible. This is telling because this is similar to how Shaul describes Yahweh's Torah. And the fact that it's a worldly or universal system automatically eliminates the Talmud, which at the time would have only been the Jerusalem Talmud, which is the smaller, lesser revered Talmud to the Babylonian Talmud, and was just beginning to take shape. So it was not completed old, and it wasn't worldly. It only influenced a tiny, tiny portion of 1% of the world's population. So that's not possible. For those who are messianics and Hebrew roots devotees who claim that Paul was assailing rabbinic law, it's not possible here. The tenses and the terminology don't allow it. There's only one candidate, and that's the Torah. well, it'll actually be the Torah, as Yahweh's teaching is found in the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. It's the entirety of Yahweh's revelation, the plan that he put in place. Now, Paul uses anonos, it's A-I-O-N-O-S, ionos, as if it was synonymous with the world as it presently exists. See, that's how he deploys it in his first letter to the Corinthians in 8:13. It is used to mislead people into believing that there is an order of Melchizedek in Hebrews 5:6, when there is no such thing as an order of Melchizedek. We've talked about that on previous programs. Then in Ephesians 3:9, another one of Paul's poison pen letters, Shaul again deploys aionos to speak of a mystery which has been hidden by God from the beginning of the world. But it is his selection of aionos in Colossians, another one of Paul's letters, 1:26, which is especially telling, revealing. There, and once again in association with mysteron, something which is a mystery, both secret and mysterious, something unspoken, and also apokrito, depicting that which is hidden and concealed, we find aionos depicting past ages, especially with regard to previous generations. So let's turn to that letter and examine what Paulos had to say about the mysterious and hidden aionos. This discussion begins with the self-proclaimed apostle making a number of claims, which we'll have to postpone to our program tomorrow because we're run out of time today. May Yah bless you. We'll be back with you tomorrow.